It's good to see everyone this morning. If you will, turn in your New Testaments, 1 Corinthians, the 6th chapter. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, we're going to pick up in our study of the 12th verse. And we'll get out to verse 20 in just a few moments' time. And there will be a section before we get into the 7th chapter, which will be dealing with a number of different issues. Where the Apostle Paul is answering questions concerning marriage between a believer and unbeliever, the state of marriage, the responsibilities of marriage. Again, between the believer and unbeliever is one part of that, one aspect of it. But various issues. And, chapter 7 is a chapter that is often misunderstood. It is used quite often to rationalize false positions and immoral practices. And so we're going to have some issues that we're going to be talking about when we get into the 7th chapter of 1 Corinthians. In fact, for the next, perhaps the remainder of our time, although I guess in chapter 6, as we begin discussing the concept of brethren going to law, or going to court, going to sue other brethren, as one that is, the meaning of that, the limits of that, the application of that is something that is somewhat difficult. But what the Apostle Paul is doing is dealing with a number of what we might refer to as sticky situations. And that's the way sin works. When sin is practiced and sin is defended, then the very clear principles that govern our behavior and our actions can somewhat become difficult to differentiate between that and maybe sophistry, individuals' attempts to rationalize their practices, and even just the matter of application. Okay, here's a clear principle of truth, but there's this situation in my life, so how does that clear principle of truth apply to this particular situation? And that can be sometimes a bit more difficult to ascertain or to establish. And I'm not saying the truth isn't clear. I think sometimes, again, the circumstances of men sometimes make it a bit more difficult to apply that truth. And what the Apostle Paul is dealing with, problems, circumstances, situations that that the Corinthians were involved in, questions that they were asking him, where we have applications of truth. And so it's very beneficial, but it is sometimes a bit challenging. And we're entering that portion of our discussion of 1 Corinthians, where we'll have some weeks where we'll certainly be challenged by what we're discussing. And that will kind of begin with our discussion today, although I think that this idea of sexual immorality in general is one that is well understood. Some of the phrases that he uses and the arguments that he makes are things that perhaps are a little bit more difficult for us to understand. So we're going to try to explain those as easily as we can. Okay, as we begin this morning, a couple of things to keep in mind. It's obvious as you look at the creation account that is found in the first several chapters of the book of Genesis, that sexual desire is something that is ingrained in man for a very specific purpose and reason. That is the propagation of the species, the earth, the replenishing of the earth by mankind. It's a very strong urge, as we understand. But what is also very clear and established from the very beginning is that God intended for that urge to be satisfied in a marriage relationship. And so a man shall leave his father and mother, cleave to his wife, the two shall become one flesh, where God is joined together, let not man put asunder, as Jesus stated in Matthew 19, as he related that text there in Genesis account. So it is to be satisfied in the marriage relationship. Hebrews chapter 13, Hebrew writer said that marriage is honorable before God. The bed is undefiled. Whoremongers and adulterers God will judge. When you have such a strong biological imperative, you have individuals who act upon that without benefit of marriage. It has happened again and again and again throughout the history of mankind. Men have practiced the sexual activity outside of the marriage relationship. That is, of course, condemned by God but it is nevertheless something commonly practiced. And you see individuals who rationalize that in our time, just as you have in times past. The pagan societies that surrounded the Jews and were present in the first century as well were societies that did not have such moral limitations assigned to their religion. Immorality was practiced commonly. But there were certain things that were taboo, things that were not allowed. In fact, one is mentioned in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, where we have a man who was engaged in extramarital relations with his father's wife. And we take that most probably to refer to his stepmother. But this was a thing that was not even named among the Gentiles. This is something that wasn't practiced commonly by them. It was not acceptable behavior, and yet it was being accepted by the church there in Corinth. So the practice of sex, the limitations of that behavior, what God has intended for man, though it is a delicate subject, it is one that the Bible makes mention of on many occasions and takes up a good portion of the 5th, 6th, and 7th chapters. In chapter 5, dealing with an individual who is sexually immoral, beginning in our section in chapter 6 and verse 12 and going through the end of the chapter, dealing by principle with the concept of sexual immorality. And then certain aspects of the marriage relationship and the responsibilities of the husband and wife within marriage in the 7th chapter as he takes up that particular topic. Sex is the topic that's on the table on these particular occasions. So we're going to be talking specifically about the practice of fornication in our lesson today. The King James Version renders the Greek word porneia as fornication. The New King James Version renders it sexual immorality. And by the way, I think though I understand the fact that the term fornication is one that is not commonly used in the English language today, it is the best phrase to use as contrasted with the more general term sexual immorality, because the phrase sexual immorality could be somewhat nebulous. And in fact, in our society, it is translated differently. And there are distinctions that are made, and there are questions that are raised by such a generic term, whereas fornication is something that is more narrowly defined. When we talk about sexual, we talk about many things. When we talk about immorality, we talk about many things. When we talk about sexual immorality, we might have in mind many things. But the actual term that is used in this context, as well as other contexts, is actually a fairly limited term. We might would use terms like lewdness, salaciousness, lasciviousness, licentiousness to describe other types of sexually immoral behavior. But when the term porneia is referred to, it has reference to unlawful sexual intercourse. It has reference to the sexual act that is outside of the marriage relationship. And that's what's under consideration here. Now, it doesn't make any difference in the sense that as to try to differentiate as to the nature of the sin, as to the how egregious the sin is, or anything like that. Well, absolutely not. Lasciviousness can condemn you just as quickly as actual fornication or adultery or homosexuality or any other type of sexual sin. However, it is important to differentiate, if for no other reason than in Matthew chapter 19, when Jesus uses the term is used with regard to that for which there is just cause to divorce the guilty party and remarry. So we have to differentiate in that particular case, lest someone say that an individual who is guilty of, let's say, lusting after a woman in his heart, that individual would be subject to being divorced, and in this part we have the right to remarry. That's not what's under consideration in Matthew chapter 19. It's not what is under consideration here in 1 Corinthians chapter 6. So it is important that we define the term and that we be sure of what we're talking about when we're talking about sexual immorality. We're talking about sexual intercourse or activity, the sexual act outside of the marriage relationship. Now, having said that, suppose someone came up to you, as has commonly been said in our time, saying something like this, that monogamy is something that is unnatural. Man is an animal, and man has biological urges, and sexual activity is no less natural or than eating is. And as such, we should not deprive ourselves from eating. That's something that is needful for the welfare of mankind and his, whether it be physical health or mental health or social health or whatever. And the same thing is true with regard to this other biological urge. The reason that I use that particular argument, because again, it is something that is very, very common. There are individuals today who will look at Christians with their taboos or prohibitions against sexual activity, limiting it only to one man and one woman within a marriage relationship. And even going so far as to say not every man and woman who are legally married have the right to engage in such sexual activity. And they'll say, well, that's just absolutely absurd. What you're doing is against what is human nature. And I think that perhaps there was some of that argument being made in the first century with regard to the practice of sexual immorality. Because you'll notice a statement in verse 13 of 1 Corinthians 6 where it says, "Foods for the stomach and the stomach for foods." Well, that's a statement that the Apostle Paul says is true. But a corollary that would say, or a logical statement that would be, if you've had any kind of standardized testing in school, you'll be familiar with these corollaries, and say the belly is to food as the body is to. And the idea or the argument that would be raised if you had your A, B, C, and D under that, the belly is to food as the body is to sex. And that's not true. That's the logic that the pagans would have with regard to this. But the corollary that the Apostle Paul affirms here, and he makes an argument concerning the resurrection that is just absolutely brilliant that we're going to emphasize here that I think really settles it. But his argument is, as the belly is to meat, so the body is to sacrifice or service to the Lord. And that's the parallel. That is the accurate, correct parallel, as God has created us. And it has to do with our very creation with regard to the use of our body and the purpose of our body. It's affirmed in other places, Romans 12, other places, but it's being affirmed by the Apostle Paul here as well. So an argument is being made as to the purpose of the body, and the purpose of the body is not sexual immorality. It is not fornication. And that's the argument that he's making here. So let's begin with verse 12, read down through verse 20. And we'll look at these verses flesh out the point that we're making here as the Apostle Paul affirms it. In verse 12, "All things are lawful for me, but all things are not helpful. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be brought under the power of any. Foods for the stomach and stomach for foods, but God will destroy both it and them." Now, the body is not for sexual immorality, but for the Lord. And the Lord for the body. And God both raised up the Lord and will also raise us up by his power. "Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a harlot? And certainly not. Or do you not know that he who is joined to a harlot is one body with her? For the two," he says, "shall become one flesh. But he who is joined to the Lord is one spirit with him. Flee sexual immorality. Every sin that a man does is outside the body, but he who commits sexual immorality sins against his own body. Do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit who's in you, whom you have from God, and you are not your own, for you were bought at a price? Therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's." Now, again, as we've stated, there are a number of themes that go throughout certain parts of the book of 1 Corinthians, and in chapters 5, 6, and 7, the sexual theme comes into play. I want you to note verse 12 and the first part of verse 13 also ties in with a later discussion in chapter 8 where the Apostle Paul talks about conscience and our behavior toward one another with regard to things that are lawful. So he's making an argument and introducing a concept that he'll touch upon later as a part of this discussion with regard to sexual immorality. So let's first of all just clarify what he's saying in verse 12 of the text. First thing, when he says that all things are lawful for me, recognize that he is not saying that I can do everything, that there are no things that are condemned by God. All things there are limited, all things within a particular context. And this is something that we can describe mathematically. If you have a set of numbers, so you're considering, for example, and discussing a set of numbers, and we'll say the numbers are even numbers, you could say that all these numbers are divisible by 2. And that would be an accurate statement. You could even say, if you're talking within the... we don't have to say all these numbers. If you're talking about a particular set, you could say all of them are divisible by 2. Or all are divisible by 2. And you recognize that when you're saying that the number 3 isn't divisible by 2. At least not wholly. And as a result of that, that doesn't apply to another set of numbers. Now, there are certain times when you're saying all numbers where you might make a statement. And when you're talking about all numbers, not a certain set of numbers, well, then something different may be so. The all is more inclusive. All can, of course, it may not be inclusive of imaginary numbers. I know that those exist. I don't understand them. But there are numbers, and there are imaginary numbers, rational numbers, and irrational numbers, and all those kinds of things. I've forgotten that. I used to know some of that, but I've forgotten. But the point is that all does not always mean all. You have to understand within the context of what all is. And that becomes obvious as you get into the 8th chapter when he begins to talk specifically about meat, which is brought up there in verse 13. Foods for the stomach, stomach for the meat. Stomach for foods, excuse me. Or meat for the stomach and the stomach for meat is this kind of the King James Version. That's why I'm using the two interchangeably. Actually, the term foods is the more accurate in explaining that. He talks, if you'll notice, in 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 8 of the text, food does not commend us to God, for neither if we eat are we the better, nor if we do not eat are we the worse, but beware lest somehow this liberty of yours become a stumbling block to those who are weak. And so the concept that is enlarged in chapter 8 is what is being discussed in this particular text. He's not saying that sexual immorality is lawful for him, or that murder is lawful, or that drunkenness is lawful, or that hatred is lawful. But there are certain things that fall within a particular parameter that are acceptable to me. They're lawful to me, but that doesn't mean that in that broad set of things that are lawful for me, that I'm going to appropriately engage in or imbibe in those things. That's the point that he's making. And most probably, what this is an indication is of the Apostle Paul's recognition that the dietary restrictions that were so prevalent in the Old Covenant have been set aside. He deals with this not only in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, but also in Romans, the 14th chapter. And the recognition that there are no such dietary restrictions. You remember way back in the book of Acts, in the 10th chapter, as the vision appeared to Peter, and the voice with regard to both clean and unclean animals, saying to Peter, "Rise, Peter, kill and eat." And Peter's objection, "Not so, Lord. My lips have never touched any unclean thing." And God's statement, "What God has cleansed, thou must not call unclean or common." And so there were certain things that were restricted under the old covenant that are no longer restricted. They are allowed. So when we talk about things, about actions, about objects, or what we can do, what we can't do, what we can eat, what we can't eat, all those kinds of things, I want to understand that there are basically three areas that where these things can lie. First of all, things that are commanded by God. If there is something that I am commanded to do, then I do not have freedom with regard to that. I do not have choice with regard to that. I am compelled, if I'm going to please God, to do what He has commanded me to do. There are also things that are prohibited, things that I cannot do, things that I cannot engage in, activities, things that I cannot have. I cannot have my neighbor's wife. I cannot engage in drunkenness or gluttony. There are things that are prohibited by God. Again, I don't have a choice in that. I either refrain from doing those things that God has prohibited, or else I displease Him and I risk His condemnation as a result of that. Then there's a third group of things. And that's what's under consideration here in this context in the statement, all things are lawful for me. Also 1 Corinthians 8, also Romans 14. Those are things that are allowed but not required. In other words, they're not prohibited, but they're not commanded. I can do them or not do them. I have discretion here. I have choice. But the point that he makes in regard to this is in those areas, even in the realm where I have choice, there are things that God permits. We read verse 8 of 1 Corinthians 8. Food does not commend us to God. Neither if we eat are we better, or if we do not eat are we the worse. Doesn't make any difference. You can do it or you cannot do it. Doesn't make any difference one way or the other to God. However, there can be abuses of those things. So the statement that he makes, all things are lawful for me, but all things are not helpful. Well, the word helpful there means expedient. And another word might be beneficial. So even though something may be allowed, it may not be helpful, expedient, it may not be beneficial. In the context of 1 Corinthians chapter 8, the Apostle Paul had the liberty to eat meat. But if he ate meat in a particular situation, in a particular circumstance, the eating of that meat may be destructive to the conscience and the faith of another individual. So even though he had that liberty, it would not be helpful for him to exercise that liberty in that particular place, at that particular time. And so he said, if exercising my liberty, if doing what is lawful for me to do, will cause my brother to stumble, well, I'll never do what's lawful for me to do. That doesn't mean that I'll never obey God. That means that those liberties, those things that are allowed, I'm not going to do them if it's going to cause my brother a problem. So there are two things that are mentioned in this particular text. As he's introducing and basically distinguishing between the idea of food or meat and sexual immorality. The two things that are under consideration here is one thing, just because I have the right to do something doesn't mean that I should do it, that it's going to be helpful in that particular case. Secondly, the statement that all things are lawful for me, but I will not be brought under the power of any. We need to be careful with regard to such activities, such liberties, that they do not become addictive, that they do not become something that we place too much importance upon and become a slave to. And that's another consideration. By the way, with regard to that, you say, well, what are these things talking about? It could be talking about a number of different things. I would hesitate to apply this to things like drug use, which is addictive or can bring addiction. We're not talking about necessarily physical addiction. The reason I would say that is because drug use is sinful. And we're not talking about sinful things here. But let's talk about things that begin to take up too much of our time and our attention. And so in my case, since I have an interest in golfing, I have liberty to golf. It may not always be an expedient thing. It may cause a problem. If, for example, if objections were raised in the church with regard to those actions, or it may cause an individual to shirk his duties because that's what he wants to do, then it may be something where I would preclude myself from engaging in such an activity. But the major problem would be it becomes addictive. And I like it so much that that becomes most important to me. That takes up too much of my attention, too much of my time as a result of those things. Other duties and responsibilities that I have are shirked. Then we've got a problem with regard to it. And I will not allow anything like that, those things that are lawful, those things that can be done to make me their slave. Because that becomes idolatry. Covetousness is idolatry. If you put family before God, then they become an idol to you. Anything that displaces God is something that's inappropriate. So those are the two principles that are under consideration in regard to this. And he uses that, and he brings food into the equation. But I think that verse 12, as he uses that and brings food into the equation, which is something that indeed is lawful, I think that the purpose of verse 12 and 13 is more fully realized when you get into chapter 8. Because he immediately begins talking about sexual immorality and discussing sexual immorality as contrasted with the eating of foods. So now he is talking about something that's not lawful, something that is prohibited, something that is condemned by God. So I think as you look at verse 12 of the text, it serves to introduce the concept of foods, which is a lawful thing. But sexual immorality is not a lawful thing. And we need to recognize that that is the case. But anyway, that principle in verse 12, we will revisit that principle and talk about it in more detail when we get into the 8th chapter and talking about conscience and the eating of meat as we continue on. But just keep in mind that principle there that is found in verse 12. Now, having said that, in verse 13, there is that corollary that we have referred to, this logical statement, foods for the stomach, stomach for the foods. Now, that's true. God created the stomach to digest the food that man needs to exist. And so the stomach was created specifically for food. Now, it's a non-technical description. It's the kind of description that you would give to your children. It's not in any way scientifically incorrect, because the upper and lower intestines and the process that saliva plays and the breakdown of the food and that aren't mentioned. He's just making this corollary here as he's pointing it out. So understand this: the statement is made, God will destroy both it and them. Okay? And here's the contrast. This is the really neat argument that he's making here. What you're indicating when you're talking about body, and you're talking about belly and food, and then body and sex, especially sexual immorality under consideration here, the two are not logically tied in together. It's not an appropriate correlation to draw, because you have two things that are physical, the food and the stomach. And it says that because they're both physical, God's going to destroy food. He's going to destroy the stomach. But in the other parallel that you're trying to correlate with this parallel, with regard to the body and sexual immorality is a physical thing. And it will indeed one day cease. Any kind of sexual activity will one day cease. You remember the Lord's statement to the Sadducees? When the Sadducees brought up this convoluted story concerning the woman who had seven husbands, and they all died, and then she died, and whose wife will she be in the resurrection? And Jesus said, you do err, not knowing the resurrection, not understanding the resurrection. In the resurrection, they do not marry, nor are given in marriage, but are in marriage, but are as angels. Sexual activity is something that is physical. It is something that is on the earth, but not so with the body. Not so with the body. And so the argument that he's making there in verse 13, food for the stomach, stomach for foods, God will destroy both it and them, but the body is not for sexual immorality. The body is for the Lord. So you cannot correlate it. You can't say the body is for sex, because that's not the purpose of the body. That's not the reason why the body was created. The body is immortal. You say, wait a second, we're talking about our mortal body. I understand that, but understand that in the resurrection there is a transformation. This mortal body puts on immortality. This corruptible body puts on incorruption. In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, we all shall be changed. And so God has created us for the Lord. And that's the argument that he's making. What you're saying isn't logical. What you're saying doesn't make sense. What you're saying doesn't follow with regard to sexual immorality, because God did not create the body for sex. God created the body for the Lord. That's the point that he's making. Now, he created the stomach for food and food for the stomach, but he did not create the body for sexual immorality. Now, I would say that you could broaden the term. You could say that the body's not created for sex in general, but that's not the point that he's making here. He's condemning sexual immorality here. And the argument that they're making is that, hey, we're made this way, so it's right and it's proper to indulge ourselves. God is the one who determines what is right and what is proper with regard to the body, because God created the body for service to the Lord. So God makes those determinations. And that argument, again, is from the resurrection. We made an allusion to 1 Corinthians chapter 15, where I quoted that. So it's found within that same context in chapter 15, verse 42. The resurrection from the dead, the body sown in corruption, raised in incorruption, sown in dishonor, raised in glory, sown in weakness, raised in power. It is sown a natural body, it's raised a spiritual body. There's a natural body, there is a spiritual body. And so it is written, the first man, Adam, became a living being, the last Adam became a life-giving spirit. However, the spiritual is not first, but the natural, and after the spiritual. Well, that's exactly what he's saying in verse 14. God both raised up the Lord. Jesus has been raised from the dead. He will also raise us up by his power. This is the body that you're talking about. It's a transformed body when it's raised up. But that's the body that you're saying, or you're arguing, is all right for fornication. And what I'm saying, Paul says, I'm saying that it has been created for a more glorious purpose than that. And so we should limit ourselves and not engage in such activity. Now, another passage, and then I'll open it up to any discussion or questions you might have. Romans chapter 12. It's another passage that we're very familiar with, first two verses. But the principle is more generally or broadly applied here. It's a we ask ourselves the question, why is it that we're to present our bodies as living sacrifices? And the Apostle Paul here says just that. Present your bodies as living sacrifices, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. Do not be conformed to the world, but be transformed. So here is specifically saying, do not do those things that are characteristically worldly, but instead transform yourself, renew your minds, and present your bodies as living sacrifices. Present your bodies as sanctified or holy. Present your bodies for the practice of those things that are authorized by God, and limiting yourself from those things that are proscribed by divine law, so that you will show yourself approved by him. These things are reasonable. God is the one that created the body. God is the one who determines what uses are appropriate or right, what are acceptable, what are holy actions while you're living on this earth. So that when that time comes where the transformation takes place, where the corruptible puts on incorruption, where the mortal puts on immortality, then you will be privy to that. You'll be a part of that. You'll be available in those things instead of condemned by God. So that's a more general, broad application of that. We're to present our bodies as living sacrifices, holy and acceptable to God. So God is the one who determines, since the body belongs to the Lord, and the Lord is for the body, or the body is for the Lord is for the body. Since that's the case, the Lord is the one who determines what actions are acceptable, what actions are reasonable, what actions are lawful, not man. And so the naturalistic view that that exists with regard to sexual practices, and you know, who needs a piece of paper? What's the big deal about a piece of paper that says I'm your husband or you're my wife? What's the big deal about making sure that you're compatible before you get married? What's the big deal about sexual activity as long as no one's getting hurt, as long as individuals are consenting adults? And you get involved, of course, homosexuality into this, or any other kind of a sexual variation that you want. Individuals argue these things, not recognizing that the body is not for sex. The body is for the Lord. And it was created in that way for God. And as such, God is the one who determines what the body can be utilized for as we live upon this earth. And that's the argument that he's making there. Okay? So, as that argument continues, just to make the point, verses 15 and 16, he's arguing it clearly in verse 14, but then he makes the application. Don't you understand, do you not know, that your bodies are members of Christ? So it's again talking about the relationship that we sustain with Jesus Christ. We're Christians now. We've got this relationship. So, should I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a harlot? Prostitute. Now that's a very bold statement. It's a kind of an exaggeration in the sense of what he's doing. We have a tendency to minimize sexual immorality. You know, we want to differentiate. There's one thing about having extramarital affairs. Let's say a man with his girlfriend. Or someone who's committed in a relationship. There's a difference between that and going and hiring a prostitute and having sex with a prostitute. Those are two different things. Well, not really. Not in kind, not in their nature. And that's what the apostle is indicating. When you're doing what you're doing with regard to sexual immorality, what you are in effect doing is being unfaithful to Jesus Christ. Members of Christ, and joining them to a harlot. Do you not know, verse 16, he who is joined to a harlot is one body with her. The two shall become one flesh. He who is joined to the Lord. And there is the key. You're a Christian now. With regard to the body, with regard to your actions, that when you are engaged in sexual immorality, then you are being unfaithful to the Lord, because the Lord is joined to our body. Our spirit is with Him. If you'll notice there in the latter part of verse 17. And so, this is why it's such an egregious thing. So someone says, well, you know, I was unfaithful to my spouse. I was unfaithful to my boyfriend. Unfaithful to my girlfriend. But when you talk about that, that's the way the world talks. Because by being with your boyfriend or girlfriend, you're engaging in sinful activity itself. But the idea of this of unfaithfulness, understand this, that as a Christian who has given himself to Jesus Christ, when you engage in sexual immorality, you are being unfaithful to Jesus. It's not merely unfaithfulness to your spouse, you're being unfaithful to Jesus as well. And that's the argument that he's making. So he's telling them this is not a minor offense that we're discussing here. It is a major thing. It is the nature of sexual immorality. This sin is very egregious. Okay? So, anyway, that argument is a very interesting one, and I think a very powerful one, that's found in verses 14 through 17. So anybody have any questions, comments concerning what we've discussed so far? Yes, Kyle?
My comment in 12:1, where it says, present your bodies as a living sacrifice. This gives us directions for our lives as well. Our bodies are lives. It's like a compass. And it is a constant reminder of the way we are supposed to be, and that we are to be glorifying the Lord in all of our actions.
Yeah, and I think when you're comparing Romans 12, 1 and 2 with 1 Corinthians chapter 6, and verses 12 and following, what you have is a principle that is established in both places. In chapter 6, you have a very narrow application of that principle. In Romans chapter 12, the principle is applied very broadly. And you're right. The idea that we have that our bodies are presented to God as living sacrifices will govern every aspect of our life. Every decision that we make, every direction that we go, all that we do in our lives, that is one of the overriding considerations that govern the decisions that we make. Are we presenting ourselves as holy before God in our actions and our behavior? Because that's something that we reasonably are expected to do. And Romans 12 is a wonderful passage as far as broadening the concept that he establishes here in this particular case. Yes?
Those of you us here present have been trained over many years by the Word. Imagine being in this society and converting someone out of a society where going to art is a perfectly normal thing to do. And they had been doing it. Verse 11 says, and such were some of you. So they were doing those kinds of things. And so it's not a stretch of my imagination to think that there in the first 15, that's exactly what he's talking about, at least for some of them. And imagine the problem we have now taking 10 individuals and changing them and saying, you can't do this anymore. And then and say, okay, I know that, but he's got to fight into that. So that's the problem on one hand. We get into chapter 7, we're going to see those who didn't have that problem. The problem they had was, what am I going to do now that I'm married to this kind of person? I'm living with this kind of person. It goes with the harlots. And what do I do now? Should I divorce him because I need to be pure? So we've got different mindsets, and he's dealing with all these problems. That's just a mess.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And I think that the way he does it is as powerful an argument as you possibly can make. Again, you know, when you consider sexual immorality, even in these cultures, even though it was something that was acceptable, socially acceptable, often practiced, there's no setting aside the fact that such activity, let's say a husband who's frequenting the temple prostitutes, that that's an insult to the wife. In other words, it's something that is demeaning to her. Every culture, I think, recognizes that those things are violations. But it's something that's commonly practiced, and it would be very difficult to be convincing if the only appeal that was made was the treachery that is done to the other person, to the wife in this particular case. But when you've got someone who has named the name of Christ, and he is affirming his faith in God, that he is a bondservant of Jesus Christ, and you tell them that this allegiance that you've placed, first of all, to God, is being violated by this practice, where there's no stronger argument that can be raised. I remember I was asked to write in college. It was a paper that I was asked to write. I forget exactly what the purpose of the paper was. But it was in a psychology class, and the general idea was the shaping of your values and shaping of your ethics. And the point that I made as a teenager growing up and such, with regard to those ethics, is that there were, of course, the instructions given by my parents, the values that were established in my home as a result of that. But ultimately, for me as a Christian, was that recognition that God is aware of all that I'm doing. And even if my parents' instructions and my desire to please them and my fear as to the consequence if they were to be disobeyed, those things certainly played a part in my decisions as to how I was going to conduct myself. But ultimately, as a Christian, it all comes down to what pleases God and what is acceptable to Him. I don't know if I got a real good grade there because of the secular nature of what is expected in those kinds of situations. But as Christians, that's what animates us. That's the reason why we do what we do, because of our fidelity and faithfulness to Jesus Christ as our Lord. And for someone to come along and to tell these individuals that, hey, you are actually being unfaithful to Jesus Christ by engaging in this activity, well, that would be something that caused them to sit up and take notice. So, yes, Dave?
Well, it's so true what you say when Christian or anyone commits sexual immorality, it's a sin against our Lord, and the Apostle Paul stressed that in Ephesians 5. We talk about the wife and the husband, love the wife, and then he sums it up there in starting in verse 30. For we are members of his body, of his flesh, of his bones. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. And then 32, we tie in what we're saying there. It says, but this is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church, and that each one of you in particular so love his own wife as himself, and the wife sees respect her husband. But this mystery they're talking about here is of the two becoming one flesh. This is stressing how that concerning Christ and the church, all emphasizes that this is against our Lord when sexual morality
that's something that's very clearly established in our context. Okay, that gets us down to verses 18 through 20, and there are a couple of issues to arise that we're not going to be able to detail in our remaining time, so I'm just going to kind of introduce it for you to think about it, and then we'll get into the verses 18 through 20 next week, and then into the 7th chapter. But as a result of the argument that he made concerning the nature of sexual immorality, he says in verse 18 to flee sexual immorality. So we're in the word flee means to flee. It means to run away from it. One thing, of course, for individuals who are single, those who do not have the right to engage in sexual activity, it's something certainly that needs to be considered, especially in a culture where such sexual immorality is promoted. And when we talk about the dating practices of our culture, when we look at the fact that individuals have ample opportunity to have opportunity, I guess there are ample opportunities for individuals who desire to do so to engage in sexual activity. The best way to handle that kind of thing is to run away from it. And we live in a society where intimacy is something that is regarded as acceptable and even to be encouraged with regard to developing of relationships. And such intimacies have naturally consequence. They inflame passion and can lead individuals to engage in sexual immorality as a result of those things. And what the Apostle Paul is saying, run away from those situations and circumstances. And it's not necessary. There are many individuals who have fallen in love, and they have gotten married, and they have maintained purity and chastity throughout the courting process until such time as they become man and wife. And it's just not where our culture does it. And as a result of that, these dangers arise, and rather than embracing, rather than fleeing from it, they're embraced. And you get to individuals and you say, well, why did you do it? Well, I didn't intend to do it. You didn't intend to do it. Well, you took the step to be alone. You took the step to engage in activities to inflame the passions. At what point in time did you think you were going to stop in regard to those things? That's the natural progression. And even when you get into 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter, as he talks about it's better to marry than to burn. The phrase there, burn, it doesn't mean burn in hell. It means burn with passion. In other words, if a person cannot control themselves, it's better to marry rather than to have these lustful feelings roiled up that will be practiced when opportunity arises. And so it's a very dangerous thing. So we're supposed to flee from that. So we'll make that point. There are a couple of things to mention afterwards. The statement, every sin that a man does, it's outside the body, but he who commits sexual immorality is sinning against his body. What's the distinction there between sexual immorality as a sin and others? What does he mean by that? And also with regard to the dwelling of the Holy Spirit in verse 19. So there are some things that we need to discuss as a part of this before we get into chapter 7. We'll pick those up next week. All right. Appreciate very much everyone's kind attention today.